Well, from what John just read this morning, what does this passage have to do with Solomon? I said to my wife this morning and to John and Beth, Solomon's going to come in for a pounding this morning. We need to ask ourselves this question. Did you see what's happening here? Verse 4, which John just read, "For it was so while Jezebel massacred the prophets of the Lord," verse 4, and then we see that Obadiah himself was in trouble, verse 13, "Was it not reported to my Lord," meaning Elijah, when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord? During this time, it was a dangerous job to be a prophet of the Lord. Get yourself killed. We need to ask ourselves a question. How did we get to this point? What event occurred in the history of the children of Israel where we went from David praising God that he brought the ark back to Jerusalem, Solomon building a house for God that everyone rejoiced in? How did we get to this point where we're killing the prophets of the Lord? How did it happen? What was the event? We're going to see that event this morning. It might not be the event that you thought it was. But in history, we can see events, we can see times, we can see certain things that happen that change the course of things to come. We have statements in the Bible, for example. Manasseh, when the Jews, the southern kingdom of Judah, got carried off into Babylon, and God said in very specific terms, "I am doing this. You guys are all being carried away to Babylon because of Manasseh. This is Manasseh's doing," God said in 2 Kings 24:4. Well, what's the event here? How did we get to this point? You know, it was not only dangerous to be a prophet of God under Ahab and Jezebel, it was also very dangerous, you may recall, to own an attractive vineyard. Near Ahab and Jezebel, that you didn't want to give up. That could get you killed. And it did get someone killed. Naboth, you'll recall, got him killed, and then got his whole entire family, or all his sons, we know. All his sons were killed as well. How did we get to this point? What happened? Well, turn back with me, if you would, to Ecclesiastes. What happened was nothing less than a complete revolution. Let's see what kind of revolution that was. Ecclesiastes, chapter 3. Verses 16 through 22. "Moreover, I saw under the sun in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. And in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. There is a time, there is a purpose for every work. I said in my heart, concerning the condition of the sons of men, God tests them, that they may see that they themselves are like animals. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to the animals. One thing befalls them, as one dies, so does the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all return from the dust, all return there. They come from the dust and all return from the dust. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men which goes upward, and the spirit of the animals which goes down to the earth? So I perceive that nothing is better than a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage, for who can bring him to see what will happen after him?" Well, what did happen after Solomon? Pretty much complete destruction, as we'll see this morning. We're going to see this morning that Solomon presided over a tremendous kingdom that influenced the entire world. We will see that this morning. And in 17 short years, his son managed to destroy everything, to bring the kingdom to a place of abject subservience. A complete disaster. How does that happen? Was it just really 17 short years that Rehoboam was king? Or was something different happening here? This is a question that we must ask ourselves. This happens in nations, and it happens in families. How many of us know a family that started out wonderfully, started out positively, started out with great promise, and then 20, 30, 40 years later, disaster? What happened? Was there an event? Was there a time when we got off the tracks, that we can go back and say, you know what, that was an event that started this mess? I have a rather unusual, for me at least, quote in the back of your bulletin. This is professor and author Otto Scott from his book, Robespierre, The Fool as Revolutionary. If you know much about the French Revolution, it was a true revolution. What we had here in the United States, if we can just steer off a little bit here and come back, we never really had a revolution as such. If you read the Declaration of Independence, those who wrote it didn't really have a problem with being English. They just wanted to be treated as Englishmen, frankly. And their complaint was with this present King of England. Do you remember that from the Declaration? This present King of England is what they said. It wasn't really a revolution as such. A revolution is where the source of law is entirely changed and rejected, and a new source of law is introduced. That's a revolution. The English common law was the basis of law during the time of the British rule, if you will, when the colonies were called colonies. But then when they were no longer colonies of England, the basis of law was still the English common law. Not the case in the case of the French Revolution. And in this quote from Otto Scott, he says, this book that he's writing does more than strip the historian's enamel from the French Revolution. It makes clear how young, remember that word, we're going to get back to that later, how young French intellectuals, the heirs of the Enlightenment of the late 18th century, launched the first revolution in all history against the idea of Christianity and Christianity's God. The effort was followed in due course by Russian-oriented members of the Third Socialist Internationale, who changed their names first to Bolsheviks and then Communists, and were followed by a long train of similar anti-Christian revolutionaries, including Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, Castro, and various other grotesques. The source of law had changed in France. This morning, sadly enough, we're going to see that the source of law changed not under Rehoboam, who managed to ruin everything, but at some point, it appears to have changed under Solomon himself. We say this morning in your bulletin that Solomon's depression was justified. Why is this? It is because all of Solomon's fears about his successor were quite justified, as they all came to pass. Let's take a look at that again. Let's take a look at Solomon's fears. Verse 22, which we just read, of chapter 3. I perceive that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works. In his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? Solomon's concerned about who's coming later. We saw that earlier in chapter 2. Let's read it, go over it again. Chapter 2, verse 18. Then I hated all my labor, in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. We have that answer this morning, as we'll see. Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I have toiled, in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. Well, what are we to say about this morning? Was Solomon's depression justified? Again, as we said, and we'll keep saying throughout the series, We want to pat Solomon on the head when he gets depressed over who's going to come over after him and say, that's all right, Solomon. Everything's going to work out. How can we even say that? How can we say that to a person who's as depressed as Solomon is, who was suicidal at one point, as we saw, who sees no favor and no merit and no profit in anything that he does because he doesn't know who's going to come after him? How can we just pat him on the head and say, Solomon, it's going to be okay? How do we know that? You know, I wonder if Solomon knew something that we don't know. Because it wasn't okay, as we'll see. The person that came after him wasn't wise. The person that came after him did destroy everything that he did, everything that he had done. And that's what makes Solomon's conclusion at the end of the book that much more important. We said earlier that Solomon runs into a sovereign God. And that's why at the end of the book he says, this sovereign God, forget about everything else. Fear God, keep his commandments, that's your whole duty. That's what is needed when we come face to face with a sovereign God. But at this point this morning, while some light is shining through, Solomon is still having a difficult time, still depressed, and for good reason. And I want to take it back to a verse that we looked at last week. It almost looks like it doesn't belong, but I think it's going to make sense for it, a lot of sense to us as we study this week. Look at verse 15. He says, that which has already been and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what has passed. What's that verse doing there? God requires an account. How's that fit into Solomon's experience? We're going to see. What we're going to do this morning is we need to see the full effects and cause, both the effects and the cause of Solomon's depression. We say that Solomon was wise and his son was a fool. This is abundantly clear. That's true. But we must conclude then that Solomon did not teach Rehoboam, his foolish son, anything. Right? Solomon was wise. Rehoboam was a fool. Obviously, he didn't teach Rehoboam anything. This is only partially true. Solomon did teach Rehoboam plenty, but it wasn't good. So while we see Solomon as a sort of victim as the saga unfolds, let's remember one thing. This revolution, accomplished in only 17 years, did not start with the foolish son. Rather, it started with a wise king who was seduced by his many wives to idolatry. That's where it started. That's how it always is, right? The idols always look good at the beginning. But the idols begin with Solomon, as we'll see in a moment, and they end up with Ahab killing all the prophets of the Lord. It started with a wise king who was seduced by his many wives to idolatry. It was at this point that the seeds of revolutionary destruction were first sown. Solomon was unable to pass on the wisdom, but he was able to pass on the wickedness. Isn't that the way it is, dads and moms, in our home? How fast will our children see our failures and imitate them? But it's long, hard work to build them up, to show them how to act righteously and godly. A lot of work there, not so much work the other way. But Solomon did teach Rehoboam something. He taught him to be an idol worshiper. Are we being a little bit hard on Solomon? Let's look at 1 Kings chapter 11, shall we? It's because of this passage that some people say Solomon never really did come back around. I believe that he did, but you won't know it from this passage. And the seeds of destruction have frankly already been sown. 1 Kings chapter 11. Difficult passage to read. But Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. Now remember that daughter of Pharaoh there. Just remember that. That's going to be interesting later. From the nations of whom the Lord, verse 2, had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love, and he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. For it was so, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. These are wicked idols here, child-sacrificing idols. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord, as did his father David. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem, and for Moloch, the abomination of the people of Ammon. Moloch, another god that needed children to be sacrificed live to him. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So the Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods, but he did not keep what the Lord had commanded. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, God had spoken to Solomon directly a couple times before, he's talking to him again. This message is not as attractive. He said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant, my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. So we know from this passage that Solomon at least knew that something bad was going to happen in the days of his son. Now recall all the things that he kept saying. Who knows who will come after me, if we wise or foolish, if we'll undo all the things I've done? Well, let's take a look. Let's take a look at Rehoboam and Solomon. And there's a lot about Solomon and Rehoboam in Chronicles. What we're mostly focusing in is the book of 1 Kings. I'm going to ask you to follow me in a bunch of different verses here. And we're staying mostly in the book of 1 Kings. It's just easier to follow that way. There's seven things that Solomon did that I want to point out. And then I want to point out the seven things that Rehoboam did to undo all that Solomon had done. But before we do that, there's one thing I want to show you. One thing I want to show you here. I want to show you that Rehoboam did learn from Solomon. Look at 1 Kings chapter 14. Verse 21. Solomon did manage to pass on something to Rehoboam. And Rehoboam, verse 21 of chapter 14 of 1 Kings, and Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king. He reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city which the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. His mother's name was Naamah, an Ammonitess. Not a good start. Now Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins, which they committed more than all that their fathers had done. For they also built for themselves high places and sacred pillars, wooden images on every high hill and under every green tree. There were also perverted persons in the land. They did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. It didn't start with Rehoboam, my friends. This started with Solomon. It's hard to say, but it did. And this is what Rehoboam picked up from his father Solomon. And you see the progression there? They start with these wicked idols. And before you know it, perverse people are filling up the entire land. And yes, my friends, today in North America, we do have a pervert problem. But it starts with an idolatry problem somewhere. And idolatry always starts with kicking out the laws. And that's what we're talking about, the revolution, right? A revolution is a change in the source of law. And our revolution has been going on for a long time. You want to be mocked? You want to be laughed at? You want to be attacked and maligned? Talk about the law of God. Any other law is legit, my friends, in North America today. Anyone, except for one. And that's the only one, the true law, the one that we should be going by. That's what's happening here with Rehoboam. Complete disaster. Well, what are the seven things that Solomon did that Rehoboam managed to undo? Solomon asked for understanding and ability to discern between good and evil. He presides over a united kingdom of rejoicing people. He receives tribute from foreigners. This is prior to his apostasy, of course. Foreigners even come to hear him, number four. He builds the temple, number five. He establishes friendships, number six. And he encourages rejoicing in the light of God's goodness, number seven. We're going to quickly look at these verses that show these things, and then we're going to take a look at Rehoboam and what he managed to do to destroy all that Solomon had done. First of all, he asked for understanding and ability to discern between good and evil. 1 Kings chapter 3. Go back there if you would. Chapter 3 and verse 7. We'll be bouncing around a lot this morning. 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 7 through 9. Solomon sees God. God appears to him. The Lord appears to him. And let's just look at verse 7. Now, O Lord, this is Solomon's prayer. Now, O Lord, my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Job's too big for me. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil, for who is able to judge this great people of yours? Just a brief word on that verse 9 that we just read. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart. He's off to a really good start here. He understands that leadership is service. He understands that it's not his job to rule over these people with an iron fist somehow and get them to do what he wants to do. And let's go out and march out and conquer other peoples. No, the first thing he says is give to your servant. Why does he say your servant? Because he realizes the people that he rules over are not really his people. They're God's people. This is a point that every leader must understand. Every politician, every societal leader, and yes, every pastor. The pastor must first understand that the sheep in the flock are not his sheep. He is serving his own master, and he serves God. And every time, especially in the Old Testament, you see this, where God cracks the whips on the false shepherds, you know what he says? He says, you've been oppressing my sheep. They were never, ever designated to the shepherd, ever. They were always God's people. Solomon gets it here. Therefore, give to your servant in the midst of whose people? In the midst of your people. What a good way to start out. You know what? We'd say, I think I'd like wisdom to rule over my people, since I'm king and they can serve me. Now, Solomon starts by serving God here. Then he asks for wisdom. And look what he asks for. That I may discern between good and evil. That was his concern. I want to know what's right. I want to know what's wrong. Do our politicians are even concerned about this today at all? It's so discouraging. You know, our politicians today, and I would hope not guided by our pastors and our theologians, would say, you know what? You need to know how to really rule people. You need to understand power. Solomon's not concerned about power here. He's concerned about understanding the difference between right and wrong. And, of course, by extension, getting that done throughout his kingdom. What a good start. Secondly, he presides over a kingdom of rejoicing people, 1 Kings 4:20. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. This was quite a time in Israel's history. And Solomon is presiding over it. Thirdly, He receives tribute from foreigners. And this isn't the only verse, but look at this. Look at this. So Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. You see what's happening here. Solomon starts out by wanting to serve God, discern between good and evil. He gets wisdom from God. And instead of other country, you know, being Attila the Hun and Alexander the Great, by going out and conquering other countries by his superior military power, he does conquer other countries. They bring him tribute, but not because he went to them and beat them up militarily. No. Because he had great wisdom and great knowledge. And they came to him on that basis. And that's what Deuteronomy 4 is all about. You remember Deuteronomy 4? Where Moses said, the other countries will see your wonderful laws. And when they see your laws, they will inquire as to your God. Now we said a revolution is a change in laws, right? But we didn't go far enough. Because ultimately a revolution is not so much a change in laws initially. It's a change in gods. Because when we change the God, then we change the laws in time. And that's how the prophets of God were ultimately killed by Jezebel, right? We have new gods around here. So the prophets of the old God, the God of the Bible, they have to be eliminated. So, that's how Solomon, he presides over a united kingdom of rejoicing people. He receives tribute from foreigners. Foreigners come to hear him. Look at chapter 4 and verse 34. This is an important verse that does not get the attention that it should. And men of all nations from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. So he receives tribute. Foreigners come to hear him. We do not know the extent exactly of Solomon's influence. But here's a verse here who tells us that Solomon was influencing the entire world. And as one writer has pointed out, one lecturer, Bo Marinoff, has pointed out, Solomon's influence can be traced through secular history. Back to Solomon. Yeah, people say today, well, hey, other countries had laws too. It's not just the Hebrews. We can do without the Hebrews and the Hebrew God. But Bo Marinoff has pointed out that prior to Moses, there was no such thing as the rule of law. It was only power. Do you understand the difference here? Do you understand that in our system here, that we are supposed to be allowed to say to a police officer or to an entire army of police officers, we're supposed to be able to say, where's your warrant? We don't care how many guns you have or how many tanks or whatever. You don't have a warrant from a judge. You can't come in my house. That's the way it's supposed to be. That's the rule. That's a picture of the rule of law. The law is greater than any one person. But if you don't have that, you're down to might makes right, and whichever king has the biggest armies and the biggest swords and the biggest guns, he rules by his word alone. Prior to Moses, there was no such animal as the word, as the idea of the law. The law that governed everyone. Solomon's spreading that out here. He's spreading out his wisdom. And what's his wisdom based on, my friends? Wisdom is based on the fear of the Lord. His law, his word, his judgments, his ordinances, his statutes. Men of all nations come to hear him. Number 5. We won't read the whole chapter, but chapter 6. Really chapter 7. Solomon builds the temple. We won't read the whole thing. Solomon builds it. We'll see how that works out a little bit later on under Rehoboam. And number 6, he established friendships. Look at 1 Kings chapter 5, verses 7 through 12. Look what he's able to do here. So it was, when Hiram heard the words of Solomon, that he rejoiced greatly and said, blessed be the Lord this day, for he has given David a wise son over this great people. And Hiram sent to Solomon, saying, I have considered the message which you sent me. I will do all you desire concerning the cedar and cypress logs. My servants shall bring them down from Lebanon. And he goes on. And in verse 12, the Lord gave Solomon wisdom, as he had promised him. And there was peace between Hiram and Solomon. And the two of them made a treaty together. It seems that later on Solomon made treaties through marriages. This appears to be a treaty made between Solomon and Hiram on a different basis. And his basis was that at least for now, they're both serving the same God. Why should we fight with other countries that serve the same God as we do? You see, if the entire world served the God of the Bible, you want peace? You want peace in the entire earth? You know how to get it? The entire earth serves Christ. That's the basis of real peace. In society, and frankly in your family as well. That's the basis. And number seven, he established friendships. Number six, number seven, he encouraged rejoicing in light of God's goodness. Look at 1 Kings chapter 8. Long chapter. Verses 62 through 66. Look at this. How would you like to have lived during this time? Then the king and all Israel with him, this is Solomon, offered sacrifices before the Lord. And Solomon offered a sacrifice of peace offerings, which he offered to the Lord, 22,000 bulls. Wow. And 120,000 sheep. What a party. So the king and all the children of Israel dedicated the house of the Lord. And it goes on about the feast. Verse 65, the end of verse 65, the Lord, before the Lord our God, 7 days and seven more days, 14 days. On the eighth day he sent the people away, and they blessed the king and went to their tents joyful and glad of heart for all the good that the Lord had done for his servant David and for Israel his people. What could possibly happen? Think about the high point that Israel was at this point. Solomon is presiding over rejoicing people. They love him. They love God. They sacrifice to God. They love each other. What can happen? Talk about a high point. Could anything tear this thing down? If it did, it'd probably take hundreds of years, right? Well, let's look at the next king. Quickly, Rehoboam. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 12. 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 6. And our first point under Rehoboam, we have seven counterpoints. So instead of asking for understanding and ability to discern between good and evil, as Solomon did, he rejects understanding. That's the first thing that he does. First point, he rejects it. How do we know that? Look at this. 1 Kings 12, 6 through 8. When King Rehoboam consulted the elders who stood before his father, Solomon, while he still lived, and he said, how do you advise me to answer these people? And perhaps I should give a little background here. Rehoboam becomes king. Jeroboam shows up, who was an enemy of Solomon, and says, well, how are you going to rule over us? And they all speak to him, verse 4, well, I should go back a little bit. He said, your father made our yoke heavy. Now, therefore, lighten the burdensome service of your father, and this heavy yoke will be put on us, and we will serve you. And this is the older folks has actually said this. And he says to them, depart 3 days and come back to me. And the people departed. Verse 6, then we just read, King Rehoboam consults the elders who stood before his father. They still lived. And he said, how do you advise me to answer these people? And they spoke to him, saying, if you will be a servant to these people today and serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, they will be your servants forever. But he rejected the advice which the elders had given him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him, who stood before him. Now let's just stop here for just a minute. Most of the time when we read this passage, you're probably very familiar with it, we say, well, you know, there was just dear King Rehoboam, and he went to the younger folk or the older folks and, listened to them. And then he went to his contemporaries and listened to them, and he waited. And then he thought, I think I'll go with the advice of the younger folks. That's actually not what happens. He rejected wisdom. See, he did what we do. Look at this. Verse 8. He rejected the advice which the elders had given him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him and stood before him. You see what happens? It's something we do, isn't it? Right? Hey, you know, I just want to get all the angles. And all we're really doing is rejecting wise counsel until we can find the right counselor who will tell us what we want to hear. And that's exactly what Rehoboam does here. It says it. He rejected the advice of the older men prior to going to that of the younger men. So instead of asking for understanding, ability to discern between good and evil, he rejects understanding. First thing, right out of the chute. Secondly, instead of presiding over a kingdom of a rejoicing people, he divides the people and goes to war against them. Look at 1 Kings chapter 12. Jeroboam and all the people, verse 12 of chapter 12, came to Rehoboam the third day as the king had directed, saying, come back to me the third day. The king answered the people roughly and rejected the advice which the elders had given him. And he spoke to them according to the advice of the young men, saying, my father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, I will chastise you with scourges or scorpions. So the king did not listen to the people, for the turn of events came from the Lord, that he might fulfill his word which the Lord had spoken by Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam the son of Nebat. See what's happening here? He's dividing the people. He's not uniting them, he's dividing them up. Look at chapter 15, verse 6. This is pretty much all you need to know. And there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam all the days of his life. Solomon had presided over peace. Rehoboam institutes just one big, long war all the days of his life. Thirdly, instead of receiving tribute from foreigners, Rehoboam is denied tribute even from his own people. Back to 1 Kings chapter 12, verses 16 through 19. You probably know this. Now when all Israel saw that the king did not listen to them, we were just in this passage, the people answered the king, saying, what share have we in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Now see to your house, O David. So Israel departed to their tents. Now what's this have to do with not even receiving tribute from your own people? Watch this. Then King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was in charge of the revenue. That's what Rehoboam's concerned about already. He had Solomon, his father, asking how to discern good and evil. Rehoboam's concerned about the money. Adoram, who was in charge of the revenue, but all Israel stoned him with stones, and he died. Therefore King Rehoboam mounted his chariot in haste to flee to Jerusalem. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. So while Solomon, kings of the earth, foreigners are bringing him money, Rehoboam has managed to destroy whatever revenue system he had from his own people. I think the revenue stream from the foreigners is about to stop, don't you? That's kind of over at this point. Look at this. Instead of foreigners coming to hear him, foreigners come to destroy him. 1 Kings chapter 14. Foreigners came to hear Solomon. Not quite the same with Rehoboam. It doesn't even take that long. It happened in the fifth year. This is 1 Kings 14, verse 25. It happened in the fifth year of King Rehoboam that Shishak, king of Egypt, came up to Jerusalem, and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. Fifth year. Shishak, king of Egypt. Yeah. Instead of foreigners coming to hear him, foreigners come to destroy him. And you see who the king is that comes to destroy him? It's Shishak, king of Egypt. Remember the very first woman that it says that Solomon married? Daughter of Pharaoh. Made an alliance by marriage with a foreign, godless king. It seemed like the right thing at the time, But it's a king from that same country that comes to destroy his own son. My friends, where is our faith and trust in the Bible for what it actually says? Or are we actually looking at it to see what benefit it has for us at the time? And if we read the Bible that way, if we're reading it for the benefit for us of this moment, be careful about that. Because if we begin to read the Bible that way, then we'll begin to reject the things that it says for us to do, whether there's a benefit or not. And Solomon thought he was benefiting himself by marrying the daughter of a pagan king. Destroyed his son. Instead of foreigners coming to hear him, foreigners come to destroy him. In the same passage, instead of building a temple, Solomon built a temple. Instead of building a temple, he dismantles the temple. What happens? He took away this Egyptian king. He took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He took away everything. He also took away all the gold shields which Solomon had made. Can you see the results of this revolution, my friend? Change of source of authority. Change of source of worship. And complete disaster. And we're only 5 years into Rehoboam's 17-year reign. What a zenith. What a time under Solomon. The high point of the whole world. To this mess. I mean, that's a pretty good invasion, isn't it? When you go up to invade somebody else, right? Usually you should be content, right, with taking a couple cities on the outside, right? Knocked down this city, took this city, took that city, burned a few houses, carried off some slaves. That's the way to do it. This is a thoroughgoing victory for Shishak. Goes right into the temple and right into Rehoboam's house and carries everything of value away. That's a pretty thoroughgoing win for Shishak of Egypt. So he dismantles the temple. He presides over it in Rehoboam. And number six, instead of establishing friendships, he's just a whole lot better at creating enemies. Solomon. We already saw this. Look at verses 1 through 3 of chapter 12. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had gone to Shechem to make him king. So it happened when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard it, he was still in Egypt, for he had fled there from the presence of King Solomon, and had been dwelling in Egypt. They sent and called him. Then Jeroboam and the whole assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, "Your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke which he put on us. We will serve you." Jeroboam is coming to Solomon, Jeroboam coming to Rehoboam, sort of hat in hand, if you will, saying, "Listen, can we just get along here? I think I know how we can get along." Rehoboam has a chance to make a friend here and to keep a friend. But no, instead of establishing friendships, he manages to create an enemy, which he did right here with Jeroboam, that he fought with the rest of his life. And then seven, instead of encouraging rejoicing in light of God's goodness, he encouraged wickedness and God's judgment. And those are the verses that we already saw in 1 Kings chapter 14, verses 22 through 24. Yes, he encouraged wickedness through his worship of idols. Solomon had encouraged goodness when he was younger anyway. Rehoboam encourages wickedness. Well, what are we to do with this morning? How do we conclude this? What's our lesson? Our lesson this morning, my friends, is that both in our families and in our nations, we must worship God. And if we don't, Eventually, the prophets of God will be killed. The big lie today can be seen on the back of the cars passing you on 222 or on 176 or the turnpike. The big lie is that blue bumper sticker with the white letters. You know which one I'm talking about. It's that disgusting, lying, coexist bumper sticker. Do you see coexistence in the Bible with idols and the true God? Anywhere, my friends. Anywhere. Solomon thought he could get that done. You see, I am so sure that when Solomon begins to marry these other gods, begins to worship these other gods, marries these other wives, begins to worship these other gods, I'm so sure he's saying, I'm not rejecting the God of the Bible. I'm not rejecting the God who gave me wisdom. I'm not rejecting the God who appeared to me twice. But isn't there enough room for more than one God? Can't we all just get along as far as the gods are concerned? And the answer is no. Not nationally, not personally, ever. So the choice before us this morning is the choice has always been. Are we going to follow the God of heaven fully? Or are we going to leave room for other gods? Shall we pray? Like William Cooper, O Lord, may we go to war against those sins. And every sin has an idol behind it somewhere. Somewhere we're worshiping an idol if we want to sin. May we go to war against those. And may, by your Holy Spirit working in us, give us grace and assist us to truly turn our back on all that offends. And may the things of earth grow strangely dim in the light of the glory and grace of Christ in all of us, personally, family-wise, nationally. It's in Christ's name we pray it. Amen.